What's up, everybody? This is our podcast with John Wakefield, my coach. He works at Science to Sport. John, I guess we can probably start off by talking about Science to Sport, how the whole setup came to be and how it works. A short summary, because obviously we're still going to do a lot of podcasts regarding everything.
Started it sort of just as a small coaching business on the side of his medical practice that he has, being a sports physiologist and obviously passionate about cycling. And that was probably the better half of 2006, 2005, I presume.
Sure.
And it's grown to what it is today with sort of four of us being directors at the company: myself, Jeroen, Dr. Mike Posthumus, and Ben Capistano. We basically look after about 300 athletes in total. Do a lot of research, stuff like that.
Yeah, I must say that's one thing I really like about Science and Sport, in my opinion, if I can give it, in terms of, you guys aren't working alone as opposed, so you're working in a group, which means obviously you share a lot of knowledge. So you're able to learn from the doctors and other coaches around you. And then obviously the end result would be in able to coach the athletes better, obviously.
Yeah, it's 100% correct. Like when you look at the minds that sort of are involved there, if any of us have a problem, if I've got a problem with you and it's something that I present to the three of them, we'll come up with a solution or come up with a diagnosis of what the best way forward from there is. It's not like there's four different, directors or coaches and we all work against each other. Essentially, if you do well, us as a company does well, and that's what we're looking for. It's a great support system that you have at your fingertips at the end of the day. It's for argument's sake, if I go to Mike and ask him a problem that I'm having with you, if I need help, he'll give me as much attention as he would any one of his own personal athletes to try fix a problem or to better you as an athlete. So that side, it's an environment I've never really seen before, I've never really worked in before. It's especially among coaching, it is sort of quite a selfish job and everyone wants to be better than the other guy, but I really don't feel that at the company at all.
I also have to be honest, it's not like I'm promoting you guys or anything or being biased, but as an athlete, it's a great benefit for them, because we are going to go into the topic of your personality might clash with another athlete and not necessarily the training plan. So one athlete might decide he likes this coaching style of Science to Sports. He likes having the added benefit of being able to talk to a good coach and a doctor and that, but he might prefer being coached by someone else within Science to Sport, and then obviously he has that option. So that's also pretty cool.
Yeah, and also just to kind of further from that is, say, I'm working with an athlete and exactly that our personalities don't work, but he'll work better with Ben as a personality. We'd rather keep that athlete in the company and move him over to Ben and know that he's looked after, instead of them saying, it's just your personalities aren't working with you, John, I'm out, and they leave as a client and an athlete. We've had that before, not a lot, but we've had some clients come to me and some have gone to Mike or Doc or Jeroen, or Ben. But as long as they look after, essentially, from the company's perspective, we happy at the end of the day.
Yeah, for sure. So that's why I'm also saying I'm not being biased. The same counts for any other entity that works, that has this business model. I think it's a very successful business model, when you're able to work with so many experts. Especially another thing I'd like to mention in regards with, we're touching small subjects now, but later on in the podcast we'll obviously get much more specific into things. But for example, setups as well, not just coaching. So when you're doing someone's setup and you're having a terrible time trying to find something that works for this guy, because it's not always just out of the book, this is how it should be. That's only a benchmark. So you can ask Jeroen or Mike as well for advice. And because they've had the same problem maybe with a different athlete a year before or 6 months before, they can share that with you, and obviously you all can implement in improving the client setup.
Yes, 100%. Exactly the same as, you know, even testing athletes. If, you know, Jeroen has found a better method of possibly analyzing data, he'll share all of that with us. If there's a research paper that has come out or something like that that Ben has found, he'll share it with all of us and say, hey guys, take a look at this. So that network of knowledge is really vast. As I said, it's almost like a one-stop shop.
And then obviously the I'm just going to quickly mention this, the complexity is we have to realize we all are humans and we all use different technologies. So when you do your setup at one company, how one guy sees the perspective of where your femur bone is to his eye, it might differ 1 centimeter or millimeters to another guy's. And that's only human nature, but that can completely change your setup on a bike.
Correct. And also, you know, with all the different tools or software systems that you have like available to you, that tool you've got to remember is also only as good as the person using it, you know. So again, if someone isn't genuinely clued up and knowledgeable in what they're doing in terms of the bike fit, it doesn't matter what system they are using, whether it's a plumb line or whether, you know, it's Jeroen's system of a VergoFit. If you don't know what you're doing, that setup is wrong. At the end of the day, you got to remember that.
Yeah, well, it's basically like me taking my GTI and going around a corner at 200 because Michael Schumacher can do it, and I presume I can do the same, but I can't. So anyway, okay. So
I didn't know you had a GTI. I thought you had a panel van.
Yeah, unfortunately, when I was young and dumb, I bought the GTI, and now it's standing in South Africa gathering dust while I'm busy riding my bike in Europe. So that's very smart.
Fair enough.
Okay, so another thing I'd like to quickly move on to is, in our look, obviously, this is we have to remember that everything we say here is opinion based. So we're not going to say something and then we expect whoever's listening this, because we still need subscribers, we'll see that's how it is. And this is only our opinions, and you know from your experience, my experience, what we're able to share. So how many is a maximum athletes that you would say as a coach you will be able to coach and give them your maximum?
Put into one. So like, for argument's sake, at our company we've got the three categories, being category 1, 2, and 3. Category 1 being your sort of top level, what you want, and then you get, you know, your sort of average rider that just wants to finish the Argus, as an example, and they're on category 3. So they want to do, from a 4.5 hour Argus, they want to maybe do 4 hours or 3.5, which is very less labor intensive. So how I do my stuff is I sort of categorize it, you know, I've only got X amount of Cat 1, which I would kind of call your sort of Pro Tour World Cup riders, and top elites locally. And then you have your Cat 2, which I have is very serious, but just less detailed, being like also elites, but just not at that top level. Top age group riders, etc. And then obviously your sort of it's a wrong way to say it, but like your fun riders, or just your kind of beginner intermediates. It just, you know, again, from my side, it's a hard answer to give you. You know, like from a cat one side, you can, for me personally, to give you 100% attention, you're only looking at sort of 10 or 12 of them, just because of how much time intensive it is. Where cat three, you know, as an example, you can do 20 of them. You know, it's so it's sort of how you structure stuff and that. I do have a lot of athletes personally, but that's sort of all I do. Where, you know, someone like Jeroen in the company has his medical practice and all the other stuff going on, so he can't take that volume. You know, you can't be sort of taking someone's heart out and trying to update a training program because Philly's seat's wrong. So, you know, it's all sort of it's all sort of labor intensive on where you split your time. But you know, I've heard some stories of like some coaches having like over 100 athletes, and it doesn't matter. This is my personal opinion. Like, there's no quality in that. Like, you know, maybe for sort of a quarter of them, but when you're working with that many people, that's, I don't believe for 1 minute you're giving the quality that you can produce as a coach. But again, it's my opinion, and you can prove me wrong on that.
I guess we have to take, okay, well, first of all, it's basically copy and paste, because when you have so many people that you have to give your attention to, first of all, over weekends, you're not living your own life, and you have to decide how important your own life is to you, I think, as a coach. And then also the ethical point of view of that. However, I have to mention that if you are a person getting coached by someone that coaches so many people, you also, and you're happy with what you get, that's probably your own, I won't say own stupidity, but then don't expect more, because you know the facts. So don't go and complain afterwards, if you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, like say for argument's sake, I've got like 100 athletes, and like I give everyone sort of the attention, I get all the workout and everything, but they're not getting, which is a big thing for me, that sort of personal touch, and you get to know the athlete. And then if you complain, you know, you can't sort of, you know, argue, because, you know, like you're just not getting that attention, or you're not happy with what you're getting. It's I suppose it's part of the course. Some people are fine with that, you know, and they're happy, and they progress, and they get coaching, and they go and do well, and they, everything is great. But for me personally, it's not really always about taking money and doing stuff like that. It's like, I want to see people get better. So whether that's going from a 4 hour to a 3.5 hour August, or whether it's you going from the August to pro tour, like, you know, it's about progression essentially. And if you're sort of just rushing through stuff and copying and pasting to a point, and that you aren't analyzing data, you're just giving a program, you're not actually coaching someone. That's kind of the best way I look at it. Which again is fine for some people, but it's not, I don't know, to me it's wrong.
I think there's also that aspect, whereas it's almost like a woman giving birth to a baby. It's, so for example, we will never under...
Well, some athletes are as painful as that.
Well, if you don't have one of them, I guess you aren't a real coach, because you have to have had that experience with, we all know those difficult athletes, and they are part of life. You're going to get them in the basket. But I think some things I the athlete myself won't understand is the fact that, like, obviously, regardless of how good or bad the rider is or the athlete, when you improve him, I guess you take a lot of pride out of it, because you see improvement, and you know it's something that you contributed to. So it doesn't,
as I said, like, obviously some coaches have different models. You know, I've got a friend whose sole coaching business and he doesn't work for us or anything. He's just a mate of mine, and his is really just entry level beginners, and that's it. And he thrives off it, and they do well. He has a little studio and everything, and you know that's his business model, and it's great, you know, because that's not something I would do, where you know he fills that gap and he thrives off it. So you know, to say different styles and different approaches, you know, none of them are wrong. It's just not what I would do going forward. And I don't think anyone, I could sort of say at our company, I don't think anyone else would do that either.
Yeah, never say never, but yeah. hopefully not.
I may get Alzheimer's and I may need to go that route, but for now, no.
Yeah, and okay, so I think we've got the... Well, I'm not going to say we've got anything covered, because cycling is a lifestyle, and it's such a broad spectrum of things to cover. However, I think as well to have Jeroen one day on the podcast would be great for the two viewers that we might have so far, which is myself, you, and Mundy.
and Tug, my little bull terrier, he's sitting here
as well,
interested in what's going on.
So let's quickly just move on to some news, which I'd like to quickly get into. Okay, so I noticed that from next year there won't be any more the world's team time trial for the teams are done. In a way, I feel pretty sad. I know we've got a really long, hard season, that I know, but there's always someone or some sponsors trying to get something out of it that haven't perhaps got results in the start of the year, and now they've got opportunity. So it's a really complex situation. But what do you think, good or bad, that there's not a world scene time trial for the men anymore? And the women as well, because I heard someone say that the women don't have that many big events, so the world's team time trial is actually a really big event for them. So,
yeah, that's right.
According to my knowledge, it falls away for them as well.
Yeah. From my side, you know, like, is it important in an overall picture? To me, not really. But again, it's racing. You know, guys, I'm presuming a lot of the teams do actually put a huge focus in it. And if you look at just from the men's side, if you look at the hype and the, you know, the explosion that Quickstep has created by winning it, you know, I was on a ride on Monday, and, you know, guys, stopped at a robot, there was a bunch of guys there, and they were all talking about it, you know. Yeah. So to me, it was from... Exactly that, from like a exposure, I think it's good. It adds a discipline in, it doesn't hurt anyone, it doesn't mess anything up. You know, it's also like a good pre-opener to Worlds, you know, like to get some intensity before. And from the women's side, I agree totally that it's a big event for them and it's big exposure. And women's cycling, I don't follow it exceptionally closely, but I do follow it like closely. But to me, it's an event that they need of that stature.
Yes.
You know, they don't have a Tour de France, essentially. But yet, which is a big thing for cycling, men's cycling, you know, but their racing is really good. And if you look at their TT times and stuff, they weren't bad. You know, like, they were fast. You know, so from that side, I don't see why they're doing away with it. It didn't hurt to have it there. I think it did more good bad on it. You know, if you look at social media was all over it with the race and keeping people up to date.
I mean cycling can do with any exposure that's left out there, and obviously to get new sponsors, and it's another complex topic that 100%. Obviously we'll go in, because we're jumping around topics now, but we're trying to quickly cover a broad spectrum of things. In regard with the team time trial, I don't know if people really noticed, but Etix has probably had one of the best seasons I think I've ever seen a team have my whole career, following the sport the last 8 years. And I don't know if people noticed, but normally people would think that you win a team time trial by having the best time, individual time trialists in the team. And that hasn't been the case with Etics. They don't have that. I don't even think I can name one guy in except Bob Jungles, who's transformed into a peer, kind of transformed into a peer climber for Grand Tours. But I haven't seen really one of the world's best individual time trialists in Etics in this World Championships. And they still won the team time trial. So it just shows that if the team's healthy, the riders are healthy, they work well as a group, that's how you win a team time trial.
Yeah, example on that is also when, you know, back in the day, which is, you know, it's now EF Cannondale, but Garmin Sharp, if you remember, they went on a buying spree of all the best TT riders that, that they could get their hands on at the time. And they did that for sort of 3-4 years, and they had, like, you know, Zabriskie, they had Miller, like guys that were still really, really hauling the mail. And they, you know, they were like to focus on like team time trials and stuff like that. And they also never won anything, you know, like anything major. They didn't dominate it, for the better sense of the word, yeah, back when that was a huge focus. And which goes to show you that just because you have, you know, a collection of very strong or the world's best TTs, it doesn't mean you're going to win a team time trial.
Yeah. Yeah. But okay, sorry for mentioning this, and I'm going to do it a few times so that people don't criticize us. Is we're not criticizing teams that have great individual time trialists and saying, oh, look, they're doing bad. We're just stating the facts that you don't necessarily win team time trials by having the best individual time trialists in the team. That's all we're saying. It's, you know, it's not, yeah, a lot of people think, cycling is 1+1, and you know, as we get further with the podcasts, we'll see it doesn't work like that.
And it's like saying, you know, it's like saying that Sagan doesn't have the best lead out train, and he's not, in all fairness, the world's best sprinter, but yet he's winning sprints stages against the world's best sprinters.
Exactly.
You know, so you look at it that way, that's a perfect example. It's not just about being the best at that specific discipline to win that discipline.
Well, you know, like with Sagan, him being, I think the biggest advantage he has is he's so good with his skill, so he's very economical in the peloton, which means when he gets to the finish, he's really fresh, as opposed to the guy moving up on the side in the wind probably for 20 to 50 times. And, you know, we'll also get into that, is like you move up 20 times on the side of the peloton and you're feeling good and you think, oh, it's nothing really. But actually, it's times 20 efforts, if you think of it logically.
Could be doing 21-minute all-out efforts to get to the front.
Yeah.
After 5 hours, you're a little bit tired on after.
Yeah. So it doesn't matter if you're the world's fastest sprinter, Sagan will beat you then, because he's fresh, he moves up in the middle, and he's got a lot of respect. And we'll also get into that, because once you've got more respect in the peloton, you move through gaps much more easy, because people give you a gap, as opposed to me as a first year, I have to fight for last wheel as well. So the final things I just quickly want to discuss, because this is also for the parents out there, I think, that might be listening this somewhere in the future, hopefully not in 2100 or something like that. Let's quickly talk about Remco Evenepoel, the Belgian rider. That's I don't think we've seen anyone this good at such a young age in a very long time. Here's my question to you with him being so good. I think he won his last, 30 races? You know, in...
Yeah, his win rate is 7% of his races. I kind of did some calculations and it doesn't matter who you are. You know, you basically... 50 races, he won 34 of 44 races. Like, it's one hell of a strike ratio. And when you kind of read race reports and just what people are saying, it's a lot of the time he literally attacked and rode away. You know, and they kind of knew what his game plan was, but no one could really follow him. That's, you know, that's how good he is.
That makes it even more impressive, because 100%. if I was I wasn't really good as a junior, but if I was a junior, the whole peloton was probably looking at this guy, marking him, and they still couldn't follow him. And
100%.
That really impressive. I don't even know what to say.
My only concern, like, with regards to him, and it's just because I've worked with young kids for years, especially when I did the motocross stuff, was that he's going straight pro tour with Quickstep. I know there was like a bidding war apparently between Quickstep and Sky, but you know, both great teams, like their best teams in the world essentially. But I don't know how good it is in terms of such a young, undeveloped mind, and like physically to go pro tour at 18.
Yeah.
It's not saying physically he can't do it. Like if you look at his numbers and stuff, he's punching pro tour numbers. But the point being is like that, which you'll know so much like better than anyone, is going from sort of like a junior category, like pro Conti, low pro Conti to pro tour, it's a huge jump, especially just in load and your race schedule. So, you know, can you do that at 18? Like, or will you have longevity for another 10 years as a pro? Would be very interesting to see it all. However he's managed will be very interesting.
Interesting. Yeah, because we have to take in account that at the age of 18, obviously, he's got all these agents trying to spin him a story, what is best for him. He doesn't know what's best for him.
Wants to race his bike.
That's
great.
Yeah. And we don't mean that by ugly in any means. I think all of us thought we know the world by the time we got 18 and we just wanted to go out of the house. But as we got older, you know, you realize that at the age of 18, you don't know what you want. I won't say you are uneducated or unexperienced, but your feelings do change a lot from the age of 18 to 23. Okay, then John, just a quick thing. Okay, so as we're talking about Remco Evenepoel being so good at such a young age, then there's this one rule, as I would like to call it, the 6 watts per kilo rule. So everyone, let's say whatever wattage he's riding at 6 watts a kilo, and it's almost like the two hour marathon. It doesn't really matter how fast you are really at that age, or 5 years later, you can only produce kind of so much power at around about 6 watts a kilo. So, but my question is, by the age, and I posted on Twitter as well, is by the age of 25, when you have to do so much hard work to maintain that, and obviously he's going to have to improve his endurance but keep the wattage, what do you think that will be on your mental state? You know, because then life only actually maybe starts for you. I don't know.
No, this is kind of exactly what would have been my concern in terms of him going so early to pro tour. You know, like, huge talent, like it's there, you can see it, but you know, like, can he keep it going, you know, for so long? And yes, there'll be a ceiling on in terms of his threshold, as an example, you know, but then it'll be consistency and doing it over, you know, 3 weeks of a grand tour, you know, so that's where he's going to have to see, or how his development is going to go, to kind of see how long or how much longevity he's got in his career, which, as I said, it'll be very interesting to watch. You know, is he going to come and smash 3 years and, you know, do exceptionally well and then burn out at the age of 22? You know, we've seen that happen before with athletes. You know, they've come on the scene, done exceptionally well, and kind of unfortunately not carried on and had longevity because it maybe was too early, or they were kind of pushed too much, and that load over 3 years you know, kind of had them crack. So, yeah. But again, you know, he may, hopefully, which I'm hoping he is going to do, is kind of soak it all in, and they'll develop him over slowly over time, and he'll have a really long career, because, you know, on paper, he's good, and he's got the potential. It's just they don't race on paper. That's the only problem.
Yeah. Because one thing you'll notice at World Tour, if you're not riding away at the end of a 5-hour day on a climb or in Roubaix over the cobbles, most of the time it's controlled by the peloton, and it's not like junior racing where you just attack and ride away. Those days are long gone. You have to specialize. You have to be a brilliant climber, brilliant time trialist, or a brilliant sprinter. Perhaps like a Rui Costa or Thomas de Gendt that can go in breakaways on the days that everyone are tired. So that's the four things we also will talk about later, which also be pretty cool. He's a peer talent. Coaching a guy like this must probably be a pleasure, because I guess it doesn't matter what you give him, he's just going to be good.
He's good, so he's easy to coach. But, you know, how I look at sort of top-level athletes and stuff is that essentially I put them in the same category as an artist. And, like, artists are a special bunch of people. So they're not always, typically they OCD, they set in their ways, they know what they want, very, very, very goal-driven, etc. I say this respectfully, like a little bit touched in the head, you know, with a very special personality that you have to sort of get into.
Yeah.
You know, so to say, like, he's easy to coach because he's good, like, often it's not the case. Mm. You know, it's some of your best athletes, when I say, are the hardest to coach, not in terms that they're just so difficult. It's that to get the best out of them, you really have to sort of tap into them to get the best out. It's not just giving them a week and say, yeah, go do these intervals and a long ride and have fun. It's, you know, like, it's getting them to get the best out of those rides.
And that's
where catch comes in. And the other spectrum of that is often because they're good and they think they know everything, and you're trying to kind of say, well, you know, what you're saying to me now is really wrong, and you've got to kind of explain to them why. So it's not just, like, a top athlete's not easy to work with, and not because they're difficult, it's just that they're a very special breed.
It almost makes you think of Socrates or Aristoteles, who said that you only have true knowledge once you realize you don't know anything, really, you know.
It's 100%.
You can always learn. And then one controversial thing about all of this, do you think perhaps the bid for him, we've got an idea what he's earning, what the agents are getting, what influence the parents are having, the coaches, whatever. But obviously, I haven't seen anything on how long he has signed. Have you seen anything of that?
No, nothing at all. But off the top of my head, I really doubt he would have signed for anything less than like 2-3 years.
Yeah.
You look at it, like, it's quick step to begin with. They are good at developing riders. You can say what you want on that. Yeah. They are very good at it. And they do typically give long contracts, or longer contracts than a year, like 2 years. So, and with him being so young...
It wouldn't make sense just giving him only 2 years. I would, if I was a company, I would push for even four. I don't even know if it's part of the UCI rules that you're not even allowed to give four, but I would, if someone was that young and I believed in them. I don't know.
Yeah, 100%. I would want to keep him and develop him, essentially. So, like, if there was a rule of a 3-year rule, which I don't know, as you said, but I would try to give him as much longevity as possible. An athlete I'm working with at the moment is busy trying to sort a deal. It's pretty much done, but it was like, go for 2 years, because the first year is sort of a bit of an unknown, and then the second year you need to perform, you know. So from that side, it's more of a longevity, being young, and having talent, and you want to kind of develop that into it. You know, like what if the first year goes wrong?
Yeah.
For whatever reason, he gets injured, something happens, you know, and he's out of a contract or, you know, something like that. So I would say he's probably on a 3-year deal, which would make more sense for anyone to sign something like that. Okay. And for a team to keep him, essentially.
Yeah. very true. I was actually going through some of my tweets because there's a lot of controversial stuff, obviously, you'd like to see. And I actually laughed quite a lot with a tweet from Janis Brockovic, who said, motivation alone is not enough. If you have an idiot, you motivate him. Now you have a motivated idiot. Anyway.
I followed him quite a bit when he was obviously riding pro, and now, like, obviously he seems to have taken a point of, you know, like he's looked like he's going into sort of the performance side of stuff when you look at his, like, social media and that. And I must say, I've actually started, like, really enjoying what he's been putting out. It's from everything from pretty interesting, like, sort of a scientific side to, like, that sort of controversial inside the peloton. His stuff is good. I give him that.
Then, and as we are talking about this, you know, Remco Evenepoel being so good, so young, then we look at, okay, we don't want to get the doping trolls involved yet, because we know the way they,
all the motor trolls.
Yeah, oh, please, I don't hope they catch hold of us, because then we're done. Then we might have to flee. But anyway, in regards with Chris and Geraint Thomas, we've seen them go through Barlow World. They were very average. And it just showed you by... These guys are great examples of guys being in a team, just doing... I remember when I saw Chris in my hometown... still in his Barlow World kit, I think at the Jock Tour under 16, I was under 16, under 17, just started cycling. And he said, I would never forget these words. He said he had to put his foot down because the team was just sending him to race after race. So if you get a guy that has this potential, but obviously he's running this race schedule that doesn't suit him, going to race after race, and you'll never really see the true potential that this athlete can give you. But obviously, as we all know, that sometimes as a first-year professional, you go to a lot of races to develop your body, develop your engine, and see what type of rider you are. So that's normal. But obviously, he was a bit older back then. Just your quick thoughts, like, it's really, this is also what we talk about, where it's really important to have a goal, because just by going to big race after big race after big race after big race, it's hard keeping motivation and impossible maintaining a high peak. You know, like, yeah, it's, what are your thoughts on that?
That's where, like if you start at the beginning of that, it's like to have a set race plan for the year is with specific goals is always easier to work your annual plan towards. Where, you know, someone like, you know, Geraint Thomas now, for argument's sake, has that sort of power within the team to go, I want to race A, B, C, D, F, G, and that's my schedule for the year, you know, and it'll hardly change. You know, maybe he gets sick, he doesn't go to Dauphiné and he goes to Catalunya, you know, but like it's different, you know, it's small things like that where, and I say respectfully, someone like yourself, first year pro tour, you know, you're racing a lot of races for what a normal, you know, especially from last year or the year before to what you're doing now.
Yeah.
You know, and you look at what I try to do with your stuff was yes, find some peak races, but where you have the biggest collection of races in a row, or in a period, so say over like a 3-month block, and then you have like a recovery, less racing over a month, and then another 3 months, I'd planned your training that you would carry form or be in good form, you know, for those 3 months.
But obviously, it's not the perfect way of doing it, because because obviously, when you target, let's say, a month period where you say, I believe I can win these races, obviously, I tell you this because now the feedback's important. I tell you I want to win this race in this period, and you kind of give me a high, well, whatever training load, so that I can win that. So then obviously it changes. So
yeah, it would. Like, perfect example was your calendar last year, where you went to Spain in June over that period, and that was like your big peak for the year, which was hopefully was going to get you noticed and a deal for this year out of South Africa. And then you went there and you did well, and it was great, and we were like, awesome, you know. And then all of a sudden there was a phone call saying, I've got to go back. You know, like, if I don't go back, then I'm not going to be looked at. And that really threw a massive spanner in the works for both of us. You know, so you need to, yeah, I don't know how to say it, but like, you need to be, like, there again, where it comes, going back to our first topic, is like, you need to have a genuine vested interest in what you're doing, opposed to a copy and paste program. And again, feedback from yourself is important, but it's hard work, like, to kind of run a schedule like that when you don't really know what's going on, but you have an 85% idea of what is going on. You just need to make sure that your form is good, and if there is, like, in short notice, we need to try hit a peak for that, and we have 6-8 weeks out, we can hit it, and that's, or work towards it to try hit a peak for it.
I think as we come to the end of this podcast, I think we should throw around a few topics about what we'll be talking about next, because we also need to think that we spoke about training now, what it takes, the structure, all that stuff, but we also need to think the influence the external factors have, like getting ill, which can, it depends how long you're ill, 1 week, 1 month, a virus, a bacterial infection, a stomach virus, bad teeth, irritable bowel syndrome. That's why it would be great to have Jeroen on as well, so you can obviously say the long-term negative effects of that. And then obviously making the mistake of training too hard while sick, and it can actually end your whole season. And then just from how altitude can affect us, because remember, I was a little bit too long at altitude, and my first year as a professional, I wasn't recovering fast enough. So that on my side, that's a mistake I made, and that's why I came down to sea level. And then, yeah, you know, like nutrition, and periodization of training and nutrition. And yeah, I think that would be great if we get into those stuff. And if people leave comments of what they would also like, if not, not comments, leave questions, what they would like us to discuss. And then, it would be pretty cool if we can get into that.
Yeah. And just, obviously the questions you do ask, don't ask like sort of silly questions, like ask sort of informative questions, something informative that sort of all the other listeners can listen to, as opposed to asking something like, does this guy dope or does he use a motor? Like, don't drop those questions in.
I personally think the whole motor thing is absolutely ridiculous in the Pro Tour, because I think that's also pretty cool that we can end it off on this, is just to tell the people that when I pitch up at a race, I don't even know which race bike I get. Sometimes I get my bike and it got damaged and they had to change some parts and the wrong saddle was on, and I have to let them know. So, you know, like with these people saying stuff about this guy's got a motor in this, I don't even know what wheels I get. The mechanics, they come to you in your room and they ask you, what do you want to ride?
Yeah, and just to end it off, like when I was saying, like the mechanics come to my room, they ask me, do I want to ride 303s,
405s? You know, I don't even know which is my spare bike, what is what bike. So I think the whole motor thing, this guy has a motor. Maybe in the past 20 years ago, I don't know,
if that was even possible. But nowadays, 110%, I'm pretty sure no one in a pro tour team has a motor in his bike.
When and you know, you are always, you know, when I think of it in a sense of law, when you make a precedent for something, when we look at all the times over history, from Lance's time, Balocchi, Ulrich, and even now, they kind of all ride the same times up the mountain. Obviously, they had heavier bikes.
So
and
is everyone using a motor?
Yeah, then, yeah. So if you're saying X was using a motor because he went so fast, and 10 years later, 10 Oaks are riding the same time up that mountain, you're basically saying that all 10 of those Oaks also used motors, and it's absolutely ludicrous.
No, for sure.
But then we know how some of the people argue. They will just play the player, or you know,
It makes me wonder why they watch cycling. that's another topic in its entirety.
Yeah, John, thanks a lot for this podcast. It's been awesome, and people, please remember to ask us questions, because otherwise we won't have something to talk about, and we might have to convert to talking about celebrities or something.
<That's right>.
Yeah. John.